Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, also to listeners on Radio Verulam in St Albans. Our guests this week are steampunk enthusiast Janine Marriott and also the founders of New Revolution Music Productions, Jamie Plumley and Chrissy Solis. We have features from Anthea Page, also Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Grieve reads the 16th chapter of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We've got some poetry coming up later on, and Jeff Sparks is here with his What Song Guide and Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman. In the studio with me now is steampunk enthusiast Janine Marriott. Hello.
Hello.
So what does it mean to be a steampunk enthusiast? What do you actually do?
Well, it's a bit of a hard question because I'm a fan of steampunk and I do a lot of steampunk things, but it's not the only thing I do, obviously.
Okay.
Steampunk, I think some of the things that we do as steampunks, and I'm only talking for myself because there's lots of us all over the country now, like to do things like visit historic houses.
Okay.
Go to, you know, places like museums and things like that, and tend to go as a group and like to dress up in steampunk style, which is quite a distinct style. Also go to events. There's events all over the world now, particularly in America and this country. I'll soon be going up to an event in Lincoln.
Okay.
Which is a yearly steampunk event.
It comes across initially then as a sort of like, it sounds like a sort of a loose aesthetic to which you can then sort of apply to yourself and sort of be part of a scene. What would an average selection of steampunks look like?
Oh, that is a hard question. There's no one colour that anybody wears. There's no one style that anybody wears. Though the strongest fashion element, I would say, was Victorian. So you could say it was very neo-Victorian in its way.
Okay.
And Edwardian. You get a lot of people who look in quite Victorian, Edwardian, but that can stretch all the way back to medieval style and all the way forwards to 1930s, 40s, 50s style. So you can't say that they're all going to look similar in any way.
Because it's sort of like, it sounds like sort of an old-fashioned way of doing new things. Like the punk sounds quite new and edgy.
Hmm.
So how does that sort of mix in?
Well, the steampunk name is actually a bit of a... It's a bit ironic, actually, because steampunk is the opposite of punk. Steampunk rejects a lot of the sort of some of the really modern values or modern ideas and goes back to a lot of some of the Victorian ideas. I'm not talking about putting children up chimneys or anything, but a more polite society, taking tea, being gentlemanly. There's a sort of an offshoot of it called the Chap Movement.
Yeah.
Which there was mentioned recently in The Guardian, I think.
Good Lord, right.
Where gentlemen like to, you know, smoke a pipe and be very courteous to the ladies and that kind of thing. So it's almost the opposite of punk.
So it's not necessarily a musical movement, per se. I mean, usually youth movements are always defined around music. You know, you're a mod, you're a rocker, you're rockabilly, or, you know, but or a goth. So with what sort of music would you tend to sort of affiliate to, or do steampunks like all sorts of music?
Again, it's very hard to categorise that, but steampunks, there are certain bands that call themselves steampunk, but the movement didn't come out of music at all, really. Music has come into steampunk, and there are quite a number of bands that are totally different, but kind of affiliate themselves to it. So, for example, the Men That Will Not Be Blamed for Nothing. One of their singers is actually a transvestite comedian called Andrew O'Neill, and he's coming quite big at the moment, so whether he'll be able to stay in the band or not. But they do a lot of really punky stuff, and it's very funny but very clever. Sunday Driver is another one, and they're totally different. Men Who Could Not Be Blamed for Nothing are very punk, quite heavy in parts,
right?
And Sunday Driver are a lot more chilled out, really. There's other ones. Ghostfire is another one, and the biggest one is a band called Abney Park, and they're American, and they are a massive steampunk band, and they really style themselves as steampunk, and they've got several albums. They focus more on the pirate element of steampunk, because there is that element as well. So they talk about airship pirates and a sort of real Jules Verne's type of idea of the future, but a Victorian future.
So there seems to be quite a sort of stubbornly old-fashioned mentality. Where does that come from? Is it partly due to the increase in sort of technology and the internet and all of these things just sort of... just taking things far away from sort of everyday real life and being able to do things for yourself?
There is definitely an old-fashioned element. I wouldn't like to intellectualise it that much and take it to saying that it was a reaction to that. I mean, the steampunk community use the internet all the time. There is a website called Brass Goggles, which they use constantly to communicate on. We've got our own Facebook page in Bristol. I think it's called something like the Bristol Airship and Steampunk Society, something like that, but it's in Facebook. And yeah, we communicate on that all the time. For example, we've been organising a visit to Cabot's Tower. Okay. Just because we would like to go there, and it's just been unveiled. So it's not rejecting it, but a really strong element of it is the socialising and the going out and being together and the dressing up, which doesn't necessarily happen in a nightclub or anything like it does in goth or
okay,
in punk.
So it sounds like less rejecting it, but more injecting some old-fashioned values back into the modern life, so that you've got something, you know, some sort of real spirit to how you're leading your life and what you're doing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'd have to say that most of the steampunks I know are very sort of, they tend to be very eco-friendly, they tend to be entrepreneurial. That Victorian entrepreneurial spirit runs all the way through. I know someone who's a cake maker. I know another person who builds things.
There is a big avenue for environmentally friendliness, because particularly if you're, you know, a lot of it is do-it-yourself. The punk original musical punk movement was very much do-it-yourself. Well, that's brilliant, isn't it? You know, growing your own vegetables, making your own clothes, doing your own stuff. That's what we all need, really, isn't it?
Definitely. I think everybody could embrace a little bit of the steampunk and they'd be very, very happy, because being creative, even if it's only being creative by growing your own salad in your garden, is, in a way, it's really very rewarding. And I think a lot of the steampunks do things that they find personally rewarding, and that's part of the ethos. Creativity is hugely important in the movement anyway, so people make their own clothes, they make their own jewellery, they design and make things. There is an amazing chap called James Richardson Brown who creates his own steampunk sculptures, and he's actually got an exhibition on the Kew Steam Museum at the moment.
Okay.
And he's quite well known, he's been in newspapers and stuff. But that element of creativity and making it yourself and doing it yourself is really vital.
That seems to be quite left out of, you know, a lot of what we're told about modern life, particularly on, like, you know, the way life's presented on TV and in films and in radio and so forth. You know, a lot of it is just sort of purchasing and commercialism, and you buy things, and that this just seems sort of like almost like a statement, like, everybody else, we think you might be missing the point.
Yeah, I think you may have come to it. Yeah, I think you might have a point there. Yeah, it is really a different way of approaching things. You don't just go down to Camden and buy all your outfit. You actually really think about it, you really concentrate on it, and you try to recycle or upcycle.
People might associate steampunk with comic books especially. What could you say about that?
Oh yeah, there's quite an element of comic books and all sorts of books in steampunk. So there are some steampunk comic books. I mean, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen's got some real steampunk elements to it, and obviously that was made into a film recently.
Okay.
But other things, not just comic, things like Jules Verne, all that kind of Victorian adventuring boyzone type stuff is quite strong in there, and it does influence the way people dress and things that they make.
Okay, well, let's turn the conversation around a little bit to you know, how people could get involved. I mean, when you say there's a social scene meetup, are there any sort of particular big events that people go along to get a taste of it?
Yeah, the Lincoln Steampunk event, which is in its third year now, is at the Asylum. If people wanted to go along to that, actually the tickets are all sold out for that, and they have been for months because it's very popular.
Okay, when is that?
That is the 10th and 11th of September.
Okay, so next in 2012 might be the year when people finally get to
Yes, but there's also lots of local groups. There's a local steampunk group in Chepstow.
Yeah.
There was recently one in Chepstow, a steampunk event called Waltz on the Wye. As I said, there's the Facebook group, which you can find out a bit about local steampunk events and meetups and groups. And recently I did a tour of Arnosfell Cemetery. I'm the education officer there, and I did a steampunk tour. So there's people out there organising bits and pieces, but it's not centrally managed. It's just people saying, let's go to this place, let's do this thing, and people just jump on board.
Yeah, okay. So if people want to go along to their sort of local thing, the focus seems to be a lot about do-it-yourself. A lot of people might not really have any idea. I think if you told me to make some clothes, I can't say I really know where to start. So what would you do if you wanted to make your own costume? What do you recommend?
I would recommend charity shops and flea markets and all sorts of places where you get lots of second-hand clothes. I personally collect and modify Victorian clothes for my outfits, but you can go anywhere and find bits and pieces at lots of different places, and then you just add bits on, because there's no thing that's right or wrong really. So, for example, a gentleman might go to a charity shop and find an old tweed suit. Mm. Then he may want to add some kind of leather belt that he can hang useful things on, a bit like a Victorian bat belt, basically. So he might want to hang on a pair of scissors or binoculars, something like that. So the look, if you wanted to get started, for a gentleman, it would probably be Victorian chap out on a walk, so maybe plus fours, something like that. And for a lady, it would probably be some kind of Victorian or Edwardian look, so a long skirt, but maybe with an addition of a pattern over the top of some kind of cogs. Cogs are very big.
Okay.
And probably in a shade of brown or grey is often quite popular.
Okay.
So
what is there going on in Bristol? How can people meet up with a bunch of people?
As everybody's on Facebook. Facebook is a really good place. I think if you put the words in the search engine of Bristol and steampunk, you come up with a lot. If you went straight to the main steampunk site, which is for the whole country, which is Brass Goggles, people there will be very, very happy to direct you to local Bristol events.
Excellent.
So there's also events in Chepstow.
Okay.
And also, for example, we've got a meetup coming, and I think it's Bank Holiday Monday, and it's 12 o'clock at Cabot's Tower. We're all going to meet up for a bit of a wander around the tower, have a look round, and then maybe some croquet on the lawn and a picnic.
Ah, very nice. Splendid. Well, Jean Murray, thank you very much for coming in.
Okay.
Time for a feature from Anthea Page now. With the debt crisis in America worsening, it's not only the politicians who are trying to cope with the situation. Our Anthea Page met a doctor from Arizona, and this is her story.
My name is Mary Kay.
And you're from Arizona?
I'm from Oro Valley, Arizona, but I practice in Tucson, Arizona. I'm an OBGYN, so I deliver babies and do surgeries. And as an OB in the United States, you're mandated to care, as most physicians do, for anybody who doesn't have insurance or doesn't have the money to pay. Well, you know, the United States is a wonderful place to live, and there's many opportunities for the poor in Mexico. So it's a very coveted thing to deliver a baby in the United States, because your baby, when it's born in the U.S., will have a United States citizenship and have access to the schools and opportunities that they can't get there. So these women will come over the border to deliver in the United States. Sometimes they might know ahead of time that they have a baby who's having a problem, and so they'll come for the medical care, but many times they come so that they can have the citizenship. Anyway, so they'll come and deliver, which is a big burden to the hospitals, because many of them don't have the money to pay. So there's billions of dollars that go toward the care of those who might need the care, but also aren't paying any sort of taxes or wages in the United States. So it's very difficult to be a physician in Arizona compared to other places that I've worked. It's a huge burden. I mean, I love my job, don't get me wrong, but it's almost bankrupting the hospitals. And the federal government is very slow to reimburse for the free care that we give as a physician. So I can work over 100 hours a week and maybe get paid for 30 some weeks, you know. So
there's been a big issue in the newspaper this week about the national debt, hasn't there? And it seems that America is falling into quite a bad crisis.
It's difficult, because I think they're going to have to raise taxes and they're going to have some cuts. What's the problem is there's so much corruption in the Medicaid system. The Medicaid system there is a system for people who make a lot of money, that they can get access to insurance at no cost at all for anything. So a lot of them will hide their finances, not get married, so they can get access to the Medicaid, when in reality they have nicer cars than I do and have two DVDs and have fence. It's terrible. So unfortunately, if they could clean up the Medicaid system and clean up the graft, I don't know if the federal government can do that, clean up some of the excesses. It's difficult.
So what about the drugs problem? Because you're near the Mexican border.
The thing that I see is that there's so many young people who are addicted to heroin. Is very cheap, and the black heroin that they can smoke is really very cheap in Tucson. So many kids will get hooked on the pills, and the pills are like a buck a pill for like a Percocet or OxyContin, and they can get the heroin very cheaply. So unfortunately, the drugs are cheap, so the kids are getting addicted. Even in the more affluent suburbs, it's a big problem, and we're seeing many women who are addicted to heroin, and you know, by the same token, then they aren't having access to good care for their babies or for themselves, and the babies are addicted. In terms of the violence, even women who work in my clinic who have families in Nogales, one of the techs who works in the clinic, her brother was abducted, and he was 17. He was held for ransom, and this is a family who knows the police in Nogales. they are connected family, and they knew who took them, but they still, the police could do nothing for them because it was the federales. It wasn't the police, it was the federales who had abducted her brother for $3,000 ransom. They paid the ransom and got him alive, but stuff like that. I mean, it was just, to her, you know, part of life. It's shut down her whole town. She's from Nogales, U.S., and Nogales, Mexico. They have homes in both places. It's literally shut down the towns there. There's no industry. The main street is closed down because of the violence. I mean, nobody goes to vacation anymore. It's too scary. I mean, we don't go to Rocky Point or any of these places to vacation. It's terrible. It's terrible.
I heard that the Mexicans are bringing up the drugs and then trading it for guns and taking guns back to Mexico. Is that true?
I can't comment on that. I know that they had that unfortunate operation where they were selling the drug. The Border Patrol was selling drugs, trying to do a sting operation, and it ended up that the guns were not being very helpful to catch the gun runners, and there ended up being the Border Patrol, that young man who was killed by the same guns that the U.S. had sold. It was tragic. It was a young guy. I mean, the Border Patrol are excellent, excellent. What's the word? Law enforcement. I mean, they're really well trained, and here this young guy got shot by this operation that the ding-dong Eric Holder put into place. It's ridiculous. But I work. I deliver babies and do surgeries. I can't comment on any of the where the drugs or guns go. I just see it in my patients. The addiction is terrible.
So do you think the problem is getting worse? More Mexicans are never coming over as the violence escalates in Mexico?
I don't know if I see more Mexicans coming here, but I think when the situation is so severe, you have the opportunity to live in safety and have opportunity for an education and for a job. Who wouldn't take it for their children? You know, when their towns are closing down because of the violence, who wouldn't take the opportunity to escape across the border and have a better life? I mean, wouldn't you do that? Yeah, I would, right? But I don't know the numbers. You know, I was astounded. When we moved from Minnesota to Arizona, I was astounded with the amount of drugs and people that cross that border every, like, week. It's crazy. It's tons. It's crazy. It's so much marijuana, heroin, the people. You know, it's very porous. Scary.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page. That was her in Edinburgh finding out the problems facing America on its border with Mexico. With me now is Jamie Plumley and Christy Solis, co-founders of New Revolution Music Promotions. Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
So what exactly is The Revolution?
The Revolution is we're looking into changing the way that people work throughout Bristol, promoting in ways that other people don't. We're kind of looking at bands and how promoters within Bristol are treating the bands. We're kind of looking at changing the whole style of it. We want to try and make bands benefit for what we do.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your background in this. I mean, obviously you've been around in the music scene in Bristol and seen and observed the way things are going on. So what's your background musically?
My background is I used to music promote a long time ago and I enjoyed it and it was really, really successful back then. I decided to put it all back down. But I mean, I've just been in the music scene throughout Bristol for like a long time really.
Christy, yourself?
I used to be the lead guitar player of Blake's Curse, that are going to be listening, so hi. And we made it quite big, ended up playing festivals, and me being in a successful band is like we see it, this business, from both sides of the coin, because I know what bands are looking for, and yeah. He's a great promoter. I mean, he's always friendly.
Okay, so what have you observed then, Jamie, about the way that bands are being treated? What exactly do you mean specifically?
I believe that bands, or what I'm seeing, is that bands are not being treated the way that they should be. It seems like the promoter seems to take 90% of the money and the band gets like 10% of like a night's takings at the end of the day. And we believe strongly that bands should be treated properly. And if you're a promoter and there's a band, then by rights the profit should be split 50-50, whatever way you look at it. And we're just looking to like make some honesty out of people and say, look, you know, you can't carry on the way that you do it. You just can't continue doing this really at the end of the day. So that's where the New Revolution comes into this, because we're looking to like change the way that people are being treated.
Yeah. Okay, how do you reckon you're going to implement that?
We're just going to do it bit by bit. We're going to study what's going on around us, and then we're going to gradually sort of start looking at the shows and how people are kind of doing things. We're then going to kind of put in our version of it and then take it from there.
All right, so Christy, when did you sort of start getting involved in this and meet Jamie?
I started he asked me around June this summer, but I've always done a bit of promotion for my support acts. I noticed that I'm better at persuading venues to give other people gigs than doing the gigs myself. But I'm starting a new band now called Summer Solace with Daniel Horseman, who also is helping us out a lot with artwork. And that's going to be basically a project of New Revolution as well.
Okay. There seems to be a lot of hard work gone into this. Like, we interviewed you last year, which is a whole year ago, but you've only really been running it properly for 3 months. So that's like a good 9 months of hard slog to get there. What did that involve?
Again, like looking at what other people are doing, meeting bands along the way who are willing to work with us. And we've got sort of other stuff coming up in the pipeline now. As of like last year, we had the Punk Fest coming. Well, we've still got the Punk Fest coming, but we're now looking to do like an Ozfest thing underneath the company called The Rev Fest, which is going to be Ozfest styled, which is very different, very unique. We've been doing our homework on what shows aren't there throughout Bristol, and we're trying to find the niches and the gaps that people are just not seeing, and the Rev Fest seems to be, yeah, this is what people want, so here we are, we're bringing it to Bristol.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what Rev Fest is going to be like.
Rev Fest is going to be like, do you want to say something towards that?
Yeah, we're going to have Snowblind headlining, which they're a very, very good Black Sabbath tribute band. They concentrate more in the earlier version before Ozzy went solo. They're amazing, though. We're also going to have Fixer. They're from...
Well, they're Bristol.
Yeah.
They're Bristol's sort of finest Metallica tribute band. But we've also got Dave Mustaine, Daniel Horseman.
Yeah.
He's working alongside them to make that show a little bit more unique. So
okay.
Kind of like done our homework upon that as well. We've also got Ramlight on the bill.
Yeah. And Martin Smart is an amazing person. He keeps, like, always joking around during meetings, which makes us feel very good about ourselves, having very good communication.
Yeah. Throughout this time of, from last year to this year, that's what it's been, is just constant meetings of what people want, how people want things to happen and stuff. And the Rev Fest, or the Ozfest, as it's going to kind of be presented, it's going to be something I think Bristol really is going to really enjoy. And I think if it's a success this year, then we'll continue on again next year.
I think the heavy music scene really needs this boost, because if my chronology is correct, I think this time last year the Junction had just shut, which is obviously a major place for a lot of bands, and you know, things are looking a little bit bleak for bands of that ilk.
Yeah, I don't think rock's completely dead. I just think it does need a bit of a kick up the backside, and I think some people have to realise that it only takes one person to say, come on then, let's get this together, let's get this going, before you get like I don't know, sort of 5, 6, 7 people start talking about it. It's word of mouth and kind of getting the grip on what people want. And I think it's not dead. I think that it's still there. It just needs to be presented in front of people properly.
Yeah. How do you feel about what sort of venues are on offer for bands at the moment?
Well, we have good contact with the Tunnels, which is just off Temple Meads. And Gareth is very... is cooperating with us and helping us out a lot. And we had our launch at the Croft.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes down to kind of like the venue side of things, we haven't got as much as we should have, though, within Bristol, in that we've only got a few sort of areas where we can actually work with. Because even though we did launch at the Croft, like, it could have been somewhere just a little bit better. I mean, we're trying to promote tidy shows and quality shows, and the Croft sometimes just isn't the perfect kind of place. And that's not putting it down, but it's not the cleanest of place. And sometimes you're going up on that stage and you're thinking, well, you know, there's only like 5 people in front of you and stuff. It just doesn't give you that quality element, which is where the Tunnels have been really helpful to us, because they've, since last year, they've really promoted themselves a lot better, and there's a lot more bands playing down there, and people are like recognizing the Tunnels now for more of a music venue than last year. So we're running alongside at the moment the Tunnels with all the Red Fest and Mongrels that's coming up too. And I mean, literally once that's out of the way, we will start looking at other sort of music venues around Bristol.
So I mean, tell me a little bit, I was talking to Jean earlier about, you know, that sort of do-it-yourself style sort of thing, and you know, what that means. I mean, if people are thinking, you know, I want to get involved in something like this, what does it actually mean to start, you know, your own sort of music sort of production or key production venue?
I think as long as you're knowledgeable on what's going on around you, and you're concentrated on like what it's all about, and you don't have people are messing you around all the time, you've got like, as long as you're focused on exactly what you want, then anybody can do this.
Okay. New Revolution is very much different than any other promoter out there, because basically we're not in it for the money, we're in there to help the bands and get help in return.
Okay, so how are you set up? Have you set yourself up as like an actual little company, or is it more just sort of based on trust?
It's more based on trust. I mean, we've not got a penny out of this, and I've kind of been unemployed for the past couple of years, and this now is like a project to make get bigger and bigger and bigger, basically. So basically I can turn around and say, look, you know, so yeah.
Okay, tell me a little bit about Mongrels of Rock. You've got a gig coming up. Tell me what that's about.
Mongrels of Rock, well, after the success of last year's show, we've brought it back again, but this year we've brought it back as a brand new breed. Instead of like local bands like it was last year, we've decided that we're going to kind of push the boat out and ask other people around us if they want to play for us, as it is a charity gig. We've got a 5-band lineup compared to a 4-band lineup last year. And another reason why we call it the new breed is that it's a lot more heavier this year compared to like last year's show. Last year was more rock and roll, this year is more sort of doom death metal.
Okay, right. So I understand what you, the band that comes from the furthest away is Consecration.
Consecration, yeah.
Where are they from?
They're from Norfolk.
They're from Norfolk, that's a long way to drive. Yeah. What is it? I've got a poster in front of me that you put down. It's got a picture of a dog in the front. It says, "Introducing Bruce, who was saved from starving to death in a Bristol flat." Tell me about Bruce.
Bruce, basically, he was, just found in the flat. Normally what happens with some of the dogs is they go through other people's sort of charities first before they come to Dogs Friends. Mm. And basically, I think he went through some other charity. And
Dogs Friends usually saves the dogs that were meant to be put down by other charities like the PDSA and Dogs Trust.
Okay, and so this is Mongrels of Rock. There's some money from that going to Dogs Friends.
Yeah, all the money from this year's show goes to Dogs Friends.
Okay, dogsfriends.co.uk. And Bruce was one of the people that was all helped out. People, dogs. That was, well, I slipped the tongue perhaps. One of the beneficiaries of this.
Yes.
Okay. We've got a little competition where people can win 2 tickets. Is that right? Uh-huh. 2 tickets to Mongrels of Rock, the new breed. It's going on Friday the 2nd of September at the Tunnels. If you don't know where that is, explain briefly, Christy, where that is.
It's just off Temple Meads. If you're standing by the Reckless Engineer and looking forward and you see this little alleyway that looks like leads to nowhere, is the third or fourth shed in.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But it's really nice done up.
Yeah. Okay.
It runs alongside Temple Meads. It does look just like a car park.
Okay. Okay, you're looking for somewhere that looks like a car park. But anyway, 2nd of September at the Tunnels. The closing date for this competition is the 28th of August. Uh-huh. So we've got some time yet. The question is, what was the date of the first Monsters of Rock festival? And who headlined? So if you're into your heavy music, that should be an absolute cinch to find out. Dead easy. So the email address to send your answers to is new_revolution_music@hotmail.co.uk. So if you send your answers to that, then we'll pick a couple of... well, I'm not sure how we're going to pick them.
Well, Jamie will.
Well, how are you going to pick the winners?
Who comes in first?
Who comes in first? Well, you hurry up then, hadn't you? So yes, new_revolution_music@hotmail.co.uk. What was the date for the first Monsters of Rock Festival and who headlined? And you can win yourself a couple of tickets. Chris Solis and Jamie Plumley, very briefly, what can people do if they want to find out more on the internet or contact you?
If you go to Facebook and look for New Revolution Music, you can find our promotions company. And if you look for Mongrels of Rock, you find a link to the event. And also, if you message either one of us or the company with Bristol Dialect Radio, you can get £1 off the door money.
Woohoo! Exclusive. Christine Jamie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time now for another exciting installment of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We're on chapter 16 already, and it's read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 4. The Stockade. Chapter 16. Narrative continued by the Doctor. How the ship was abandoned. It was about 1:30, three bells in the sea phase, that the two boats went ashore from the Hispaniola. The captain, the squire and I were talking matters over in the cabin. Had there been a breath of wind, we should have fallen on the six mutineers who were left aboard with us, slipped our cable and away to sea. But the wind was wanting, and to complete our helplessness, down came Hunter with the news that Jim Hawkins had slipped into a boat and was gone ashore with the rest. It never occurred to us to doubt Jim Hawkins, but we were alarmed for his safety. With the men in the temper they were in, it seemed an even chance if we should see the lad again. We ran on deck. The pitch was bubbling in the seams. The nasty stench of the place turned me sick. If ever a man smelt fever and dysentery, it was in that abominable anchorage. The six scoundrels were sitting grumbling under a sail in the forecastle. Ashore, we could see the gigs made fast and a man sitting in each, hard by where the river runs in. One of them was whistling Lily Bolero. Waiting was a strain, and it was decided that Hunter and I should go ashore with a jolly boat, in quest of information. The gigs had leaned to their right, but Hunter and I pulled straight in the direction of the stockade upon the chart. The two who were left guarding their boats seemed to be in a bustle at our appearance. Lily Bolero stopped off, and I could see the pair discussing what they ought to do. Had they gone and told Silver, all might have turned out differently. But they had their orders, I suppose, and decided to sit quietly where they were and hark back again to Lily Bolero. There was a slight bend in the coast, and I steered so as to put it between us. Even before we landed, we had thus lost sight of the gigs. I jumped out, and came as near running as I durst, with a big silk handkerchief under my hat for coolness' sake, and a brace of pistols ready primed for safety. I had not gone 100 yards when I came upon the stockade. This was how it was. A spring of clear water rose almost at the top of a knoll. Well, on the knoll, and enclosing the spring, they had clapped a stout log house, fit to hold 20 people on a pinch, and looped for musketry on every side. All around this they had cleared a wide space, and then the thing was completed by a paling 6 feet high, without door or opening, too strong to pull down without time and labour, and too open to shelter the besiegers. The people in the log house had them in every way. They stood quiet in shelter, and shot the others like partridges. All they wanted was a good watch and food. For short of complete surprise, they might have held the place against a regiment. What particularly took my fancy was the spring, for though we had a good enough place of it in the cabin of the Hispaniola, with plenty of arms and ammunition and things to eat and excellent wines, there had been one thing overlooked. We had no water. I was thinking this over when there came ringing over the island the cry of a man at the point of death. I was not new to violent death. I have served His Royal Highness the Duke of Cumberland, and got a wound myself at Fontenoy. But I know my pulse went dot and carry one. Jim Hawkins is gone, was my first thought. It is something to have been an old soldier, but more still to have been a doctor. There is no time to dilly-dally in our work, and so now I made up my mind instantly, and with no time lost returned to the shore and jumped on board the jolly boat. By good fortune, Hunter pulled a good oar. We made the water fly, and the boat was soon alongside and I aboard the schooner. I found them all shaken, as was natural. The squire was sitting down, as white as a sheet, thinking of the harm he had led us to, the good soul, and one of the six forecastle hands was little better. "There's a man," says Captain Smollett, nodding towards him. "New to this work. He came nigh-hand fainting, doctor, when he heard the cry." Another touch of the rudder, and that man would join us. I told my plan to the captain, and between us we settled on the details of its accomplishment. We put old Red Ruth in the gallery between the cabin and the forecastle, with 3 or 4 loaded muskets and a mattress for protection. Hunter brought the boat round under the stern port, and Joyce and I set to work loading her with powder tins, muskets, bags of biscuits, kegs of pork, a cask of cognac, and my invaluable medicine chest. In the meantime, the squire and the captain stayed on deck, and the latter hailed the coxswain, who was the principal man on board. "Mr. Hans," he said, "here are 2 of us with a brace of pistols each. If any one of you make a signal of any description, that man is dead." They were a good deal taken aback, and after a little consultation, one and all tumbled down the fore companion, thinking no doubt to take us on the rear. But when they saw Red Ruth waiting for them in the sparred gallery, They went about ship at once, and a head popped out again on deck. "Down, dog!" cries the captain, and the head popped back again, and we heard no more for the time being of these six very faint-hearted seamen. By this time, tumbling things in as they came, we had the jolly boat loaded as much as we dared. Joyce and I got out through the stern port, and we made for shore again, as fast as oars could take us. This second trip fairly aroused the watchers along the shore. Lily Bolero's dropped again, and just before we lost sight of them behind the little point, one of them whipped ashore and disappeared. I had half a mind to change plan and destroy their boats, but I feared that Silver and the others might be close at hand, and all might very well be lost by trying for too much. We had soon touched land in the same place as before, and set to provision the blockhouse. All three made the first journey heavily laden and tossed our stores over the palisade, then leaving Joyce to guard them, one man to be sure, but with half a dozen muskets. Hunter and I returned to the jolly boat and loaded ourselves once more. So we proceeded without pausing to take breath till the whole cargo was bestowed, when the two servants took up their position in the blockhouse, and I, with all my power, sculled back to the Hispaniola. That we should have risked a second boatload seems more daring than it really was. They had the advantage of numbers, of course, but we had the advantage of arms. Not one of the men ashore had a musket, and before they could get within range for pistol shooting, we flattered ourselves that we should be able to give a good account of a half dozen at least. The squire was waiting for me at the stern window, all his faintness gone from him. He caught the painter and made it fast, and we fell to loading the boat for our very lives. Pork, powder, and biscuit was the cargo, with only a musket and a cutlass apiece, for Squire, and me, and Redruth, and the captain. The rest of the arms and powder we dropped overboard in 2.5 fathoms of water, so that we could see the bright steel shining far below us in the sun on the clean, sandy bottom. By this time the tide was beginning to ebb, and the ship was swinging round to her anchor. Voices were heard, faintly hallooing in the direction of the two gigs, and though this reassured us for Joyce and Hunter, who were well to the eastward, it warned our party to be off. Redruth retreated from his place in the gallery and dropped into the boat, which we then brought around to the ship's counter to be handier for Captain Smollett. "Now, men," said he, "do you hear me?" There was no answer from the forecastle. "It's to you, Abraham Gray. It's to you I am speaking." Still no reply. "Gray," resumed Mr. Smollett a little louder, "I am leaving this ship, and I order you to follow your captain. I know you are a good man at bottom, and I dare say not one of the lot of you's as bad as he makes out. I have my watch here in hand, and I give you 30 seconds to join me." There was a pause. "Come, my fine fellow," continued the captain, "don't hang so long in stays. I'm risking my life and the lives of these good gentlemen every second." There was a sudden scuffle, the sound of blows, and out burst Abraham Gray, with a knife cut on the side of his cheek. "I'm with you, sir," said he, and the next moment he and the captain had dropped aboard of us and we had shoved off and given way. We were clear, out of the ship, but not yet ashore in our stockade.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve there. That was Chapter 16 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. More next week. Bristol's famous Filton Airfield is set to close soon, make way for housing, a sad symbol of Britain's industrial decline, perhaps. So, over the next few weeks, Stylect is looking back at Bristol and Somerset's role in aviation history. This week, we visit the Bristol Aero Collection, based at Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to Chairman Oliver Dearden about the development of Rolls-Royce and Bristol engines and the heyday of Bristol's transatlantic airliners.
One of the things that makes me a little bit nervous about modern aircraft, which is also happening with cars nowadays, is that they have this thing called fly-by-wire, where you're not actually directly in contact with all the control surfaces. When you actually move the stick one way, you're basically just saying to a computer, please, will you move the plane? Yeah. Now, maybe I'm a bit prejudiced, but it seems a little bit safer to be doing it this way, where you've got hydraulics and you've got a much more direct contact between the pilot and the control surfaces of the aircraft.
Yeah, yes, that's an interesting point. In the original light aeroplanes, even the little ones you learn to fly on today, the controls are still cable-operated. When you move it, you can feel the things moving. So they had to produce artificial sensing into these things. The Britannia, for instance, was different. To control an aeroplane, you've got three control surfaces. You've got your wings with movable flaps at the end called ailerons.
One goes up and one goes down.
If you want to turn, you go around a corner.
Yeah.
You've got the rudder, which is like a ship's rudder, which you don't use very often. And you've got the elevator, which if you put it up, the aeroplane goes up. If you put it down, the aeroplane goes down. Well, the other way, yeah. Normally, the whole control surface is moved when you move the controls. On the Britannia, it didn't. They had little tabs on the back, and they were the ones that moved. So, again, there were developments in those days. So the Britannia was three abreast. It flew on the South Africa, far Middle East routes, and it was the first aircraft to go in service on the North Atlantic that could fly east, west, west, east in any weather, non-stop. Up to then, they all had to stop to refuel. That this was the first to fly non-stop.
So where did they go? If they would stop up in, what is it, Greenland or somewhere?
They go to Goose Bay, Gander, Reykjavik, or even Prestwick. Sometimes they go, Prestwick was nearer to...
So they used to go really round the top of the North Atlantic in hops.
They used to go right, yes they did. And El Al Israel Airlines, they bought the Britannia, and their advert, which nobody understood, and there's one in here somewhere, said, no goose, no gander. Well, people didn't understand that it meant they never stopped at Goose Bay nor Gander in Newfoundland. But yes, or they used to stop at Shannon, refuel, yeah. Well, you've got engines next. We've now got to engines. I mentioned the radial engine, and here, perfect examples of the radial engine. This is an early one, obviously been fished out of the sea.
Yes, he's still got seaweed on this one.
Yes, indeed. We renew it every year. And you see how, in a radial engine, all the cylinders are arranged round the radius, and they're air-cooled. Now, the early days, if you know anything about engines, the valves are operated by push rods. Here's the cylinder, and there are the valves. But Fedden and Bristol were working on a sleeve valve. Now, that is, inside the cylinder is a sleeve that moves up and down, and it's got holes in it opposite inlet and exhaust ports, and there's no valve gear. And here is an early radial engine with a sleeve valve engine. As you see, it's very much neater on the outside.
Looks like there's less to go wrong.
There is, yeah. There's none of that valve gear to go out of adjustment. So there's an early sleeve valve engine. There are always an odd number of engines. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I think, yeah.
So why is there always an odd number of cylinders around these radial engines then?
Because the order which they fire in is 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 2, 4, 6, 8. And it only works with an odd number.
Oh, okay. And that's so it only goes one way, and when you start it up, it doesn't go backwards.
No, it doesn't. Anyway, they got more and more powerful. And as we look along here, we come to the Bristol Hercules engine. Now, a lot of these were built towards the end of during the war. Now, this is where it became much more powerful because you got two banks of cylinders. This is a 14-cylinder engine. And then...
Well, hang on, it says next to it, I can't quite believe it. It's 2,000 horsepower.
Correct. And then we move on to the ultimate Bristol radial engine. This is a Centaurus, which is an 18-cylinder engine. And this was developed, 2,400 horsepower, probably more than that. Now, this one is sectioned, so you can see how it works.
So you've just cut bits out of the outside so you can have a peer inside.
Yes, that's right. So these are all the big gear wheels that turn there's a propeller shaft.
And so what aircraft were these ones used on then, the Centaurus?
The Centaurus was used on the Sea Fury and various civil aircraft, yeah. The Brabazon. The Brabazon flew with 8 Centaurus engines.
Now, didn't the Brabazon have 2 engines per... Because I seem to remember it had a... It actually had 2 engines per engine, if I can say that.
It looks as though it's got 4 engines. What, in fact, it had was 2 engines mounted either side of a central drive shaft, and that drive shaft had on it 2 propellers. And one propeller went one way round, and the other propeller went the other way round. The shafts were inside each other. One engine drove one propeller and one drove the other.
Crikey, that's a bit complicated.
Well, there was one or two aircraft like that, like the Gannet. Yeah. Then the engines moved on to turboprops.
Well, first of all, what's the difference between a piston engine and a turboprop?
Well, they worked on the same principle. You compress the air, you introduce the fuel, you cause an explosion and you exhaust it. And it works exactly the same way. You've got a turbine which compresses the air. Then you've got the flame tubes which inject and fuel, you put the fuel in it. But then the exhaust drives the turbine as well as giving the thrust.
Now this is a sort of a rudimentary jet engine as well, isn't it?
It is a jet engine. Well, it's a perfect jet engine. All this has got on it, instead of using the power of the jet to propel the aircraft, it's the power goes into the shaft and it drives a propeller that's on the front. The Britannia was built like that.
So whereas with a jet, the compressor would just compress the air and then it'd be blasted out the back, with a turboprop, you've actually got the shaft of the compressor going out to the front and then driving a propeller too.
Yeah, you've got to start it somehow. But the same principle, compression, ignition, exhaust, but it's continuous. Frank Whittle was the one who really, he thought of it in the mid-30s, but nobody took much notice of him and it took a long time to develop. But yeah, the jet engine as such was thought of in the mid-30s, but it didn't come into production until early 40s, mid-40s.
Thank you to Tony Gosling. He was talking to the chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection there, Oliver Dearden. The collection is based at Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire, as he said, and open in the autumn on Sundays and Mondays. Like Kingswood Heritage Museum in Warmley and others, the Bristol Aero Collection is run entirely by volunteers, like Dialect in fact, but faces funding shortfall as part of the Libcon Coalition cuts. So if you want to visit it, do so soon. Next week, Bristol's pioneering work on helicopters after World War II. A couple of weeks ago, we had a poet on by the name of Tony D'Arpino from the United States, and he's written some poetry about Bristol. So here is an example of that, and I believe he introduces the poem himself.
To Phoenix Wharf. A long, low-sigh motorcycle, along the grove, across the light. The wharf in all its burning blur, bird, and sunset shades. The evening, carving, the morning. At Temple Meads, where the sun was once a vast grey pewter egg of dawn, now a great plate of sun in Bathurst Basin, blasts upon the ostrich her bath of light. A day of winds, bagpipes inventing the sound of barking dogs from the black barge. The old drawbridge screams and echoes back St. Augustine's reach. What is a bridge, after all, in a gull's world? The bells of St. Mary Redcliffe, change-ringing for 2 hours of rehearsal above the poet shed, the voice of mud and water, drowned by the bells and punctuated by the boom of black powder quarter-hour cannon from the Matthew, like the carillons of Coleridge at Ottery St. Mary, pealing 7 hours at a time, the wheat fields bright with fire. Vision at Vauxhall Footbridge. The same solitude at the end of each marina. Pier, the dash between the land and my water camp, where souls begin to see, to dream. Tapas and stained glass. I'm glad I wrote the voices in our bright envelopes of gas, mirror mandala, double spiral, black pearl necklace, Carib, laughter and unshed tears, or the White Horse Tavern, voting with Poe, or labor in vain, Claire's lost pub. Colors like the molten language of the glassblower's art. Two balloons in a day moondog. A perfect circle around the sun. A goddess married to a sword. A goddess married to a banana tree.
That was Tony Dolpino there. Thank you very much to him, and maybe we'll hear some more from him in the future. It's time for Jeff Sparks for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week.
Thank you, John. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 26th of August, Phantom Limb will be performing with support from John Stinnett Band and also DJ Top Rank at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance and £10 on the door. Also on 26th of August, the £10 Suit Band will be performing with support from the Poor Old Dogs at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. Gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Power Wolf. This group hail from Germany and discovered their singer in Romania, where he studied classic opera at the Music Academy in Bucharest. This is from the album Blood of the Saints, and is the song All We Need Is Blood.
Sanctus Christi animo, alleluia, amen. Corpus adonudus, alleluia, amen. Sola Dito.
That was Power Wolf with All We Need Is Blood from the album Blood of the Saints. For more information, you can check out www.powerwolf.net. On Saturday 27th of August, Face to Face will be performing with support from the Flatliners, the Archeries and also OK Pilot at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets cost £12 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 28th of August, Nova Robotics will be performing with support from Vacant Shores in the front bar of the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £3 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Our time is up. Thank you very much to our guests. We had Jamie Plumby and Chrissy Solis, and also Janine Marriott. Features were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Grieve read Chapter 16 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. We also had a poem by Tony Darpino. Waltz on Guide was by Jeff Sparks, the engineer was Mike Noyce, and the producer was Jeff Sparks. I've been John Peters Coleman. So until next week, take care and goodbye.
Yeah.